All right, let's turn to the questions. What's the... Christ.
this must be one for
How about handwriting? What's the justification for the fact that the military budget stands at roughly $668 billion, while the education budget is roughly about $68 billion?
I think the military budget is about $530 billion this year, but the justification is that the huge majority, about 90% of education spending for K-12 is at the state and local level, which I think is a good thing in the United States, and an awful lot of, as you all know here at Cal State, an awful lot of the higher ed spending, the bulk of it is at the state level. So it's not a good, it's apples and oranges comparison. The military budget has gone down this year. It's been flat for 2 years. I think we are the world's superpower, and I think it is we're spending less than 4% of GDP on the military, way below the average of the last 50, 60 years. And I think we're at risk now, actually, of cutting too much. So we can, if you all want to spend more on education here in California, you can have that fight. And we have those debates in Virginia and in Northern Virginia all the time. The truth is the federal contribution is tiny as a percentage of overall education spending.
I agree with Bill that you compare federal spending, but the states don't spend money on military spending. I further agree that we're about at the bottom of where I think we need to be in terms of military spending. I mean, yes, we are the world's lone superpower, but I like it that way. Do we really want another superpower to challenge us? I don't think so. I kind of like, probably won't last that way, but as long as we are, I'm frankly. Do I think that we should and can spend more on education? Yes. The economists did something on the real value of something, and the real sort of economic value of a really good kindergarten teacher is like $250,000 a year. The truth of the matter is that there are different things that we could do differently. We could save money here, spend money there. It's not just across the board thing. If you look at what the system of higher education was in California, to some extent still is, but what was built here is nothing short of phenomenal. There's no other education, there's no other thing in the world that was what the sort of UC system, the Cal State system, the entire thing that was built here, and to some extent it still is, even in spite of the fact that all of the thing that is going through. No sovereign in the world has educated more people longer and better than the state of California. That's just a fact. It has to change. It's come with great costs, but it's still, if you look at your system here, it's still doing a massively good job of educating a huge number of people. It can't stay the same. It obviously has to change. It has to do all those things. I suspect that it will.
And what's putting pressure, of course, on? I mean, I'm no expert in California. It's the California state budget, but what's putting pressure on education spending is basically the huge chunk, increasing chunk that health care is taking, where the state matches Medicaid, and, of course, pensions and various other things, which the state is now obliged to, and debt that the state has assumed, which is taking up an increasing part of the state budget. So, you know, you do need to fix these other parts of the state government if you really want to get education spending going up again.
Bill, let me ask you on defense spending. As Secretary of Defense, frankly, I thought I could always rely on Republicans being strong on defense, and that's now changing in terms of the politics in the Congress. Why is that changing? And I guess just generally, are we becoming more isolationist as a country?
Yeah, I don't think it's changing as much as people think. At the end of, Paul Ryan's act, the actual budget the House Republicans passed had a higher defense number than sequester, and a higher defense number actually than President Obama's budget, slightly higher. I agree that, the country's war weary, and we're running huge deficits, and a lot of Republicans are very strong deficit hawks, and so they don't want to, they think we've spent a fair amount on defense over the last decade, and we have, and we've also fought two wars, and when you take that out, actually, if anything, I think we've drawn down on the core defense capital that's there. You know much more about this than I do, but I think Republicans remain strong on defense, but I do think they have been a little bit spooked about actually aggressively making the case for more defense spending. I was a little surprised, and I argued against this, but they ignored me, as they seem to do quite often, that they accepted the sequester, basically, rather than balking at the defense cuts that were a part of it. They liked the domestic discretionary cuts. They liked putting President Obama over the barrel a little bit. They thought they could fix defense later, which they sort of did a little bit, but we're paying some price. We're paying some price for that. I don't really think I think we always worry about the country becoming isolationist. Certainly it's war-weary. It's been war-weary many times in the past after much war, you know, much bigger wars, obviously. The truth is, two things I think could tend to snap Americans out of that reality, where you look around the world and you realize if we really retreat, we're going to be living in a world that is really kind of nightmarish for not just for our kids and grandchildren, even for us in 5 or 10 years. We don't have much choice, I think, but to overcome an understandable war weariness and leadership. And I'm not being partisan here. I don't think the Republican, I mean, Romney didn't do much either. I was one of the first to criticize Romney when he gave his acceptance speech, and this was really bad, I think, at the Republican convention, didn't even mention the young men and women fighting overseas on our behalf and serving overseas, here for that matter, on our behalf. I mean, he didn't want to mention Afghanistan, but then he was getting a debate on that, and he sort of supported the president, but he sort of wanted to be critical, and so his political advisor said, well, just don't mention it at all. It's like, really? We're fighting, we have kids fighting overseas, and we're not going to, you're the nominee of one of the two major parties, and you're not going to at least take 30 seconds to pay tribute to them. That was a bad sign. I criticized him. All the other Republicans, he then sort of tried to mend his ways. And look, and this president believes that the tide of war is receding, and he's proud of getting us out of wars. Whether that was how wise that was and the way in which he did it, we can debate. But neither party right now has an incentive, really, I guess you'd say, and to really make the case as much as I would like for American world leadership and to really point out the consequences of a certain amount of retreat. But I think reality, unfortunately, is going to make it pretty clear what we have to do pretty soon.
James, let me ask you to comment on this. It really bothered me that, during the time before sequester happened, they designed this crazy sequester because they all said it was crazy.
Right.
Because they were basically saying, if we don't, we want to force ourselves to do the right thing. And if we don't do the right thing, we'll shoot ourselves in the hip.
Right.
So they don't do the right thing.
Right.
And they shoot the country in the head. There isn't any member that I talked to, Republican or Democrat, who said that this is a great thing. That they were saying it's bad. It's going to impact. Democrats said it's going to impact on domestic programs, particularly affecting programs for the vulnerable. Republicans I talked to and Democrats as well said it's going to impact on readiness for defense. Here are elected members whose responsibility it is to protect people, not to harm people, and they let sequester happen. What am I missing here?
You know what the sad thing is? The sad thing is you're missing nothing. It's actually worse than you think. This is the gospel truth. They came up and they said, well, we're going to set this booby trap because no one would ever step on it. Now, here we got low growth, high unemployment. This, according to macroeconomic advisors, which is the sort of best forecasting thing, Goldman Sachs, the CBO, all say it's between 0.5% and 7% of GDP. That's a lot. That's a lot. And we know what its sort of effects are. And we set this thing, and then we just step right in it. I mean, if you're asking me to defend this, I can't do it. And it's like if you think about it, it's one of those things, if you think about it, you just, oh, no, man, we didn't do that. But we did. And it's like, well, I don't feel it right now. Well, a lot of people do feel it right now. And then the effects of this, once you start trying to catch up with it, become more and more profound. But you don't feel if the economy grows at 1.3%, but it could have grown at 1.8. Well, it grew at 1.3. Well, if it grew at 1.8, you would be a lot of people would be a hell of a lot better off. So, it was really like it was something to see. And I don't know when historians come back and look at this that they're going to be totally vexed and totally whatever. Just a shortly, sure, people are war weary. Why wouldn't they be war weary? I mean, we've spent gazillions and gazillions of dollars, and we see, you know, and we see what's there. And, you know, we should be. I'm a Democrat that believes in defense. I think we've cut defense enough. I like having a force that's ready. I'm very reluctant. When they say Obama's dithering, you know, well, I'm sort of the pro-dither caucus. Just dither a little bit more. Think about it. Give it a, you know, sit on it for a couple of weeks, and then after that, sit on it for a couple of more weeks.
All right, moving on. Would raising the minimum wage have an impact on reducing poverty? Bill?
I mean, I don't think it would much. I think most people working at the minimum wage, I mean, I think the study shows this, are not in poverty because there's more than one wage earner in their family. A lot of them are young people. I'm not dogmatic on this issue. I don't know that it will be a big deal one way or the other. The main drivers of poverty are the general economic situation, obviously, and particularly a lot of socioeconomic factors that no one really knows how to deal with. And that, I mean, Charles Murray has a new book out that shows this very well. The fact is, people, and James and I were talking about this earlier, people with a college education, despite the current troubles of the job market, if you're coming out of college, they do pretty well in America. People who get married, people who, what's the formula for saying that? 90, if you graduate high school, don't have a kid out of wedlock, and get a job, any job, even if it's a minimum wage job, the odds are like 98 or 99%, some amazing number, that you will not be in poverty in your adult life. I mean, we have a terrible problem of family breakup and a terrible problem of some problems in our educational systems, especially in the inner cities, which I think make it very, and raising the minimum wage doesn't do much for those. But as I say, I'm not dogmatic on this. We have a federalist system in this country. Some states have higher minimum wages. Some have lower. I don't think there's much evidence that it, one way or the other, honestly, that it helps or hurts economic growth or families.
You know, let me just say, one of the great achievements of the United States, modern United States, is this. In 1964, we had an elderly poverty rate of 30%. We decided to go to Social Security COLAs. They've been massively expensive. They've cost a lot. Today, the elderly poverty rate is like 9%. That's the act of a moral and just nation. I like that. I like the fact that two-thirds of our people today, elderly people, don't go to bed cold or hungry, because that's what being in poverty means. I do think, by and large, it would encourage everybody to get a college education. A lot of people are not, for a lot of reasons, can't. And I would encourage people to get married and stay married. I think there's a lot of it's good, but that's ideal, but that doesn't happen in every kind of instance. Actually, the teen pregnancy rate, although high, sort of gone down in the country. And if we get some kind of decent growth, and I think there's some encouraging things that are going on in education, and it one of the things is, because of technology, just global economics, the less skilled you are, the less shot you got. And it's more now than it's ever been. And we got to probably do a better job in terms of lower income people or non-college people are sort of matching up skills at what people can do. It is a difficult, difficult problem, and it's not sort of one solution away. But if we raise the minimum wage, you know, somebody's making $9 an hour one day and they're making $9.75 the next day, good for them. That's a hard thing to live on. But I'm not going to sit here. I've thought about it. I wrote a book about it. I'm not sitting here and tell you that, you know, there are about 10 things you can do to help. But the biggest predictor, if you're going to be in poverty, if you were born in poverty. And I think to some extent, I find that a little offensive. I don't like the idea that the circumstances of one's birth becomes the greatest predictor of the success of one's life. That seems to me to be kind of fundamentally against what the United States is founded on. We have less income mobility now than got a lot of Latin American countries. It's actually more upward mobility than even some European countries than we have now. There's not a simple answer to it, but there are any number of things that we can do. But I do find the uncanny ability of how one is born to predict how one lives to be very disturbing.
Didn't the government fail at regulating big banks in 2008? So how do we fix problems with the banks?
Yes, the government failed. I mean, we failed in our housing policy and in our banking policy. I don't know that people expected that failure. And the irony is, of course, that the banks, which remain the most regulated part of the financial system, are the ones that almost took it down. If you had asked a lot of people on both parties, 2005, what's going to really endanger the system, I think they would have said those hedge funds. They're out of control. They're totally unregulated, basically. Hedge funds cost some of their own investors money, but didn't actually put the system at risk. It was the huge mega banks that are, of course, were quite heavily regulated by both Democratic and Republican administrations that put the system at risk. Maybe the 99 bill that President Clinton signed was a mistake that overturned Glass-Steagall. I don't have that's a complicated issue. There are arguments about why it was important to do that for international, so American banks could be internationally competitive. I'm not a big fan of the big banks. I wish the Republican Party were more concerned, willing to take on Wall Street, actually, and defend Main Street, as I said. I think they should look after the community banks before they look after the big banks. That was a failure, clearly, of oversight on both parties, and a failure. The housing bubble, which really underlay, I'd say, the financial bubble, was a failure of both parties as well.
Of course, there was a guy been dead for some time, Hyman Minsky, who taught at Washington University in St. Louis, who, against everything else, predicted that all this would happen, and it's repetitive. And Warren Buffett famously said, the only thing people ever learn from history is they never learn from history. And since the tulip bubble in the Netherlands, we've been creating bubbles and bursting and wrecking people's lives. And we've always had this. And after the Depression, we put Glass-Steagall in, and we didn't have any from 1932 or 1931 or whatever it was to list. The nature of finance is just, it's a different business. Than if the dry cleaner goes under, too bad, but the dry cleaner goes under, it's always a hell of a guy. All right? If the beer distributor goes under, then you just get your beer somewhere else. If the big bank goes under, you're on the hook. And to some extent, we're going to learn it one day. But so far, human history has not taught us. There is no substitute. And I told her, and by the way, I just want to take a second to say this: if anybody doesn't think this country has a great future, you should have been at the college today. You should have seen those young people there and the questions that they had. And I don't know if they'll put that on local access TV. You should watch it. You cannot walk away from that and be pessimistic about the future. It is impossible. But they just, and it's the famous quote by Chuck Prince, who was the president of Citibank, to say, look, as long as the music is playing, we got to dance. We know when the music stops, it's all going to hell in a handbasket. And the music stopped, and then we had to come in and deal with the consequences of it. The best thing to do is there's a way to put a system in place by a set of capital requirements and other things where they just can't do this again, because they will do it again. It cannot be helped. It always happens that way. It's just the nature of the way things work. And, just a shame, but it happened, and we hopefully...
Okay, this question actually touches on a big debate that we're, you know, that's going on in the world, particularly in Europe, and it's also here. The debate between austerity versus stimulus. We've seen what's happened in Europe, the austerity measures of Great Britain, Spain, Greece, others, Italy. And so they're going through that debate right now. What is more important, cutting expenses or stimulating the economy?
I mean, it depends. It's complicated. Both. And so, I mean, I think Europe has a horrible problem, especially Southern Europe, because of the euro, and they're in a crazy situation now where they cannot do what other countries have done. that were in trouble and basically devalue their currency and get out and take the hit once and then go back to getting some economic growth going. So I am actually, with some on the left, I am a critic of the European Central Bank and the insane, I think, effort now to impose much too much austerity on Southern Europe in a pointless quest for what? I mean, they're not going to fix the situation. And it really is terrible, the social disaster you can have when you have 20, 30, 40% unemployment, as you now have in Greece and Spain and Italy. So on that, I think that kind of austerity doesn't work. Now, can you keep spending more than you're taking in? Can every country in the world do that? No. And is it a little, you are borrowing from the future for the present? And some of those, James and I just debated this earlier, some of those borrowings are reasonable. If you're investing in the future, if you're just borrowing to spend, that's not a good idea. We're probably doing some of both. So I'm not, I'm somewhat ambivalent on some of the things. I do think growth is awfully important. I mean, if we could get from about 2% growth, which is what we've had for about the last 10 years, to 3% growth, which is about what we had, a little under what we had for the preceding 50 years, leaving aside how good that would be in so many other ways for the country, the tax revenues from that growth would actually reduce the budget deficit more than all the cost-cutting things that are being proposed. I mean, growth is very powerful. The miracle of compound interest, I think economists call it. It really is amazing. It really matters if you go 3% or 2%, not in 1 year or 2 years, but in 10 or 15 or 20 years, the degree to which one country suddenly, and one family and one community suddenly can afford a lot more than another. I mean, James mentioned Social Security. I have no problem with Social Security COLAs, but the main reason that 9% of elderly citizens, if that's what it is, live in poverty today as opposed to 30% 40 or 50 years ago, is we've had a lot of growth. If you have 2 or 3% growth for 40 years, you're going to take a heck of a lot of people out of poverty. Most of these senior citizens lived in an economy that was growing pretty well, and they could save money in a way that their parents, who lived in the Depression and started from a much lower base, lived through the Depression and started from a much lower base, couldn't. So I am on the growth side within sort of among conservatives of this debate on the whole. Having said that, there are just, if healthcare costs keep going up 8, 9, 10, 12% a year, that is also unsustainable. So you do need to be serious about some of the cost side of things.
I don't think the debate is left. I think the Bostarians are just in full retreat now. But I don't think there's anybody left making the argument. If they are, I don't know who they are. I mean, just look. And you're right, Bill is right, totally about Europe. How can Spain have a housing bust and pay back the thing without devaluing their currency or having to pay back in a German currency almost? So look what happened in Britain. I think a lot of people don't understand what Keynes was saying. The best Keynesian president we ever had was Bill Clinton and with Leon, and the worst was Bush. And I'll tell you why. Keynes said, for governments, the time to save is good times. You should actually cut spending and, if you will, raise taxes when everything is good, and then when things went bad, that's when the government should spend, because it's the paradox of savings. There's one, my savings and your spending balance each other out. If everybody saves at the same time, it's just what it is, then that's the time that the government should spend money to come back up. And that actually, if austerity actually costs, and there's a lot of research on this, actually cost money. That the Brits have really not cut their deficit by actually saving, because everybody else is saving. So you don't want to be doing what everybody else is doing. If you think about it, it actually makes some sense. But he was very, very much would have been in favor of the 93 deal, of the 96 and 97 deal that you guys made. He said that would be absolutely the right thing to do. He would have been very much against some of the stuff that was done in the mid-2000s, early 2000s, because he would say that you shouldn't be spending in good times. And it does make some sense. And that's what bothers me about it. About the sequester thing, and I go back to the point is that if you think about yourself, if you go out and you borrow money to fix your roof, that's entirely different than going out and borrowing money to go to Cabo San Lucas. One is sort of necessary, one is not necessary, and the argument that I would make on spending on infrastructure, you're going to have to do it anyway. It's going to have to be done. And so why not do it now when interest rates are at zero and people are willing to work much cheaper than they will to wait until interest rates go up and then there's real demand for labor, because you're going to have to fix the roads, you're going to have to build a bridge, you're going to have to repair the sewage plant, you're going to have to do these kinds of things that you have to do. And that now, I think, is the time to do it.
What a little bit of history lesson here on this question. Name a period in U.S. history where the political gridlock was worse than it is now. Let me make it simple for you. Why don't you do it in your lifetime?
Gridlock. You know, did much get done in the late 70s?
Look, in 1962, James McGregor Burns, who was a very well-known political scientist, wrote a book called The Deadlock of Democracy. And it was a lament that nothing could get done, that Southern Democrats controlled the congressional committees because of seniority, the parties were not distinct enough, there were too many liberal Republicans, too many conservative Democrats, you didn't have any party discipline. The American Political Science Association put out a report calling for, I think it was, quote, toward a responsible party system in the 50s. So in the 50s and early 60s, that was the sense. Wilbur Mills controlled Ways and Means, you remember all this, and nothing could get done. As soon as the conventional wisdom became, we're condemned to deadlock and gridlock forever, we had the greatest spurt of legislation, for better and worse, with the Great Society in 64, 65, 66, et cetera. So I'm dubious about it's true that there has been a fair amount of gridlock, but generally speaking in life, I find it sort of like the stock market. Whenever the conventional wisdom is one thing, the opposite is going to happen. And it's not, again, I think people overdo how much gridlock there has been. We'll see if there's a budget deal or not. But look what's happening on immigration. It's a genuinely difficult issue. I mean, if you look at the merits of these different proposals, it's not so easy to know exactly what the right thing to do is. It's easy to want to kind of balance all the right things, but it's hard to do in practice. And this is a genuine attempt to push an immigration bill through Congress with four Republicans and four Democrats. We'll see if it works. We'll see how it survives the whole legislative process. If that's happened, that's something that didn't happen. It hasn't happened since 1986. So it's not as if they were cheerfully passing immigration bills during the wonderful days of the 90s or the early part of this last decade. So I think in some areas, I think the gridlock and deadlock thing is a little overdone.
Look, this has happened since Obama's been president. We faced the worst economic crisis we've had since the Great Depression. All right? The banking system didn't go under. The auto system is up and running at some, you know, decent level. It's the first time that we've ever put, whether you like it or not, we do have national health care in place. It's starting to be implemented. We have probably over double the stock market in terms of growth. We've had the best 3 years we've had in terms of reducing the deficit in terms of as a percent of GDP. We have cut spending. We have raised taxes. We iced bin Laden. Well, we did. All right? We negotiated, so far, changes in Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, and other places under the able direction of our CIA director and our defense secretary, with minimal, if any, loss of American life. The housing market is showing some real kind of underlying signs of life here. The entire gay issue has completely turned around. I mean, in ways that no one could even sort of imagine on just the basic argument of fairness. We're proud enough we'll get there, but in terms of immigration, we're probably closer than we've ever been. We have fewer undocumented people coming into the country than we've had in a long, long time. The teen pregnancy rate is down. The crime rate is down. I mean, it's not like... Now, the growth rate is way too low. The deficit is certainly higher than anybody would like it. But we're in a sort of world economy here. But we should be honest about the problems that we have, but we should be honest about some of the good things that are happening, too. And it's not like nothing gets done, period. I mean, some things do, and I wouldn't bet against, I don't put it any worse than 40%, that they don't get some kind of a bargain before Obama leaves. I think it's like, it's hard to get from here to there. And and some of it depends on sort of where it goes. But it's, look, I know I felt this way in 2008, 2009. I was like scared. I was like, shoot. This thing don't look too good to me. And it still doesn't look great historically. And we haven't been, in terms of growth rates, if you look at the growth rates since from the beginning of this century on, they weren't great in incomes. They weren't great. One of the things is we tend to think, affluent people tend to think that our problem started in 2008.
Right.
For most people, they started a long time before that. You're like, they had pneumonia. They just got hit by a truck in 2008. But their lives weren't sort of moving. Their incomes weren't going great. Their sort of job situation wasn't great when this whole financial crisis hit. Now, they've lost 40% of their net worth, the average person. I mean, that's a big hit, man. That's a big, big hit. If you're worth, a 200 grand, and then you're worth 120, most of it's in your house, you don't feel too good. I don't like you feel good.
James, Bill, let me get you as we wind down here. This is a question that says, what do you predict for the midterm elections? And I guess the question would be, do you anticipate any major change in terms of the Republicans, Democrats in the Congress? But let me add to that question, who do you see running for the Democrats and the Republicans in 2016?
Let me take 30 seconds just to add a footnote to James' extremely sunny account of things, which I agree with. What has depressed middle class and especially working class Americans' incomes over the last 30 years? Probably globalization, a huge influx of labor coming in to compete from China and India, basically, as well as to some degree Central and Latin America. Is that a bad thing, though? I mean, it's bad for the families that are affected here. It's difficult. But net, in terms of world history, one of the great moral achievements in history is having billions, really, now of people come out of abject poverty in India and China and come into middle class or, let's say, respectable kind of working class existence with a real chance for their kids to move ahead. I think it's politically good. It's, God knows, it's morally good. And this is also happening in Mexico and Brazil to a large degree. And a large part of that, we should feel somewhat proud that we contributed to that. It's mostly the achievements of those countries, obviously, and their leadership. But we provided a world order, both an economic order and an international order, that made this possible. There have been no wars in Asia since 78. That kind of makes it, after 70 years of total chaos, that makes it kind of possible for India and China to do what they're doing. And even in Latin America, there's been bipartisan efforts to help there, and it hasn't all worked perfectly, but it's a heck of a lot different than it was 30 or 40 years ago. So I really do think even there, the downside of some of the pressure on us is a world that we can, that's better off than it was 50 or 60 years ago. And some very, very, when I went to college, people thought India was going to suffer famine and literally tens or hundreds of millions of people would die in the next few years. And China was going through a communist, the Cultural Revolution, in which tens of millions of people died. Those are pretty big things to have risen from. In terms of politics, I hope the world, and I hope we can keep the fundamental world order, which makes that possible. In terms of politics, I think Republicans are likely to do pretty well in 2014, that's what history would suggest. Six-year elections are tough usually for the incumbent party, for the party in the White House. But we've been we've been fooled a lot. The most striking thing to me is the volatility of the last few cycles. 06 and 04, big Republican victory, Karl Rove, 40 years of Republican majority coming, promptly lose everything in 06, both houses. 08, for the first time in a long time, Democrats win back-to-back double-digit gains in the House and big gains in the Senate, and President Obama wins a majority of the vote, highest Democratic vote since, Johnson in 64 as a percentage of the vote. And suddenly it's going to be a 40-year Democratic majority, except they then have a huge landslide against them in 2010. And then 2012, actually, a respectable, solid Democratic victory, but obviously not any kind of Reagan-Johnson-type landslide. So I think it's very hard to tell. It still is pretty evenly divided country. I sort of agree with James that it slightly tilts Democratic on the presidential years. Very hard to tell in the off years. If the economy comes booming back, Democrats will be in great shape. And if the world, if Obama's foreign policies work out, if the opposite happens, obviously they could punish the party in power a lot, but I really think it's a case, people are overdoing the determinism one way or the other. A lot depends on what happens in the world, and a lot depends on candidate skills, obviously.
Candidates for 2016.
Well, I'm going to let...
I'll give you the names. Rubio.
Hillary Clinton, I gather she's a possibility.
Let James handle that one. Let me ask you on the Republican side.
Okay.
You got Rubio, you got Jeb Bush. Who the hell else is out there?
Oh, well, there are a million. You were once a Republican decades ago.
Ted Cruz.
Carville's promoting Ted Cruz because Carville wants to pick the candidates in both parties. You know, he's setting up the Hillary Cruz thing. Look, I think it will be a new generation. I don't think it's going to be Jeb Bush. Personally, I think Republicans have nominated the next in line for an awful long time. They've nominated the older candidate many, many times. You know, it's been people who've served their country really admirably and people I like and respect. But at the end of the day, the Doles and the McCains and the Romneys were probably not the best candidates to be running against the Clintons and the Obamas. I think it'll be different in 2016. You may have the irony that the Democrats will nominate the old pro who almost made it the time before, Hillary Clinton. No, this is very much like what the Republicans typically do. And the Republicans may have much more of a Democratic-type primary process, capital D Democrat, with 7, 8, 9 people running. And I think they have a lot of good candidates who are young and interesting, and Rubio, Cruz, Paul Ryan, Scott Walker, Bobby Jindal, Chris Christie, people who could still emerge, actually. I think it'll be a very interesting and healthy competition on the Republican side. A lot of my Republican friends, I'll close with this, very unhappy just being Republicans. They don't like all this chaos, and they'd like to know what's happening ahead of time. Why isn't the leadership get together and select someone, or we can have all those debates again, you know? It's foolish. It's healthy for a party and healthy for a political movement. I have a lot of Republicans believe in competition. We believe in entrepreneurship. Let's have a wide open competition and let's see which politicians turn out to be the best entrepreneurs.
Let me ask James. You got a couple minutes here.
Sure. By me. Well, first of all, 2014. There basically three things can happen: a kind of status quo election, the Republicans do well, the Democrats do well. I think the most likely outcome is a kind of status quo, plus or minus 5 in the House, plus or minus 2 in the Senate or something like that. In terms of 2016, one of the things that conventionalism had always had a lot of truth to it is Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. And it was always a sort of...
Makes it hard to explain James's wife.
Right. It was always... We always wanted these big fights, and we would have this, and the Republicans always had an element of predictability to it. Right. In terms of Democrats, there's three things that I've never heard a Democrat say. One is, hey, would you grab that barbed wire and stick it up my behind? I've never heard a Democrat say that. And two, I really miss Bush. And three, I hope Hillary don't run. The truth of the matter is, literally every Democrat that I talk to says, oh, God, we don't want to fight. We just wanted to run. Just run. We don't need a fight. We just, let's go with it. And on the Republican side, and I think Bill is right, they need a big fight. They need to flush this out. This is going to be the first time in 76 years, and even, but Leon's the only one can remember this, Wendell Wilkie. Actually, from 1944, Wendell Wilkie was nominated, and he was a real surprise in 1940. From 1944 through 2012, there's always been predictable. It's the oldest white guy. If you don't believe me, look at John McCain, who is the oldest, whitest man that ever lived. I ain't never seen anybody older white than John McCain.
Jay. Let me stop you because we're running out of time.
Right. I was just on a roll.
Ladies and gentlemen, obviously there's a lot here to contemplate, and I'm glad I'm back in Carmel Valley. I appreciate both of you. It's been great, and I think it's been interesting to really talk about where our country is going and where our democracy is going in the future. Let's pray for the best. Thank you.
Thank you. Good.
He's just on a roll there.